politics, sports, entertainment, pop culture. It's all fair game here. Somewhere in the city of Toronto, two brains are about to collide. What will remain is the gist of it. Here now are Don Landry and Bill Hayes.
I'm Bill Hayes, and on behalf of myself and Don Landry, welcome to The Gist of It. This week, we'll discuss Casey Anthony, right after Don figures out who she is, Brian Burke, and what he did.
Right after I figure out who he is? Is that what you were going to say?
Pretty much, yeah. Yonge Street's changes, the sexiest subway, and speaking of the subway, the Argo subway spots, people not voting, meta world peace, and a lot more, all coming right up.
Bombs away, boys. Bombs away.
There's an anthropologist in South Africa who would like permission to exhume William Shakespeare's remains and those of his relatives.
Wait a second, let me find a punchline.
Stop. Oh, I think there will be a few. Now, Bill, the Bard has been resting in peace since 1616 in a cemetery at Stratford-on-Avon in England. Actually, since he's buried there, I guess it would be Stratford below Avon, wouldn't it?
Considerably.
But I have digressed already. New record, even for me. The anthropologist, Francis Thackeray, director of the Institute for Human Evolution in Johannesburg, believes that he has a compelling reason to answer the question, did William Shakespeare smoke marijuana? That's right, Bill. He wants to ask the question, doobie or not doobie? Now, I understand that there can be some exceptionally intriguing questions in need of answering sometimes, and they might be reason enough to exhume a person's remains. This is not one of those compelling mysteries to me. I mean, I don't really care one way or the other. If Willie went with Mary Jane while he was writing some of his most revered works in the entire canon of English literature, okay, fine. Besides, I think we already know the answer, Bill. Did Shakespeare smoke pot? Yes. Yes, he did. I mean, have you ever seen A Midsummer Night's Dream? And where do you think he got the idea for the floating dagger in Macbeth, anyway? Beware, Mr. Thackeray, because if your request to have Shakespeare's skeleton, re-enter from downstage, as it were, is okayed by the Church of England, there could be consequences. Shakespeare's gravestone reads this way, and I quote, "Blessed be the man that spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones." Now, it doesn't say, "Blessed be the man that spares these stoners, and cursed be the man that moves my stash." If you have to disturb the bard's bones, please be polite about it. Knock on the casket first, but don't be surprised if a ghostly voice replies by saying, "Dave? Dave's not here."
Doobie or not doobie, you really should be embarrassed.
I am.
Well, I have something that I wouldn't say is necessarily a little more serious, but it's more of a problem I have with the constabulary. See, I went out to play a little golf this week, and that's pretty much what I do. I play a little golf.
Very little?
Yeah. Well, mostly I commit golf. Anyways, I'm driving onto the 401, and as I was getting onto the highway, I saw an OPP officer getting off. Now, I should clarify, not at all like Shakespeare might have. No, what he was doing was getting off the highway, and what should he have to his ear but a cell phone? And I wouldn't normally notice something like this, but this officer saw absolutely no need to hide the fact he was talking on a handheld phone. I can tell you, had the shoe been on the other foot, I can assure you the phone would have been out of sight pronto. A similar thing happens when I see green hornets parked illegally as they write parking tickets for people parked illegally. As my mother used to say, do as I say, not as I do.
This from the man, folks, by the way, who a couple of weeks ago when we were recording this very program at my house on a one-way street, backed up the wrong way on the one-way. I want to know, do you and do other people who are backing down a one-way street the wrong way think you're fooling people? Well, I'm not sure what to think. He's going the wrong way, but he's in reverse, so I guess it's okay.
I've seen Green Hornets do it. Well, Don, the Argos are 1-0, winning in Calgary, and that's good for them. But I guess in the court of, well, I wouldn't even say public opinion, but at least one member of city council, they have made a big boo-boo.
Mike Layton, councillor, sent a letter to the Toronto Argonauts, and he had an objection to some transit advertising that they've been doing. They've got a theme going this year, all hands on deck. But this particular poster, which raised his ire, and the ire of some others as well, has a picture of Ricky Foley, nasty defensive end, very good defensive end. And the slogan is, home is where the heart is. It's also where we hurt people. That is the objectionable part, or was the objectionable part, to Mike Layton and to some other people who have complained to the TTC, to Toronto Council. The question
on what
is, on what grounds that, well, home is where the heart is. It's also where we hurt people. Does it not seem as though that very lightly takes the issue of abuse at home? Home is where we hurt people.
No. I didn't, you know what? Until I heard this, it hadn't even occurred to me. I was thinking, you know, football's a pretty violent game. And they're talking about at home where they want you to come and watch them. And what they're saying is they're playing a particularly physical brand of a game that's already physical and violent. I get what they're talking about. I didn't correlate the two at all.
I didn't either. And I'm a... As you know, as
big
you
CFL
are, I'm a
fan.
Long-time football fan. I just love football, mm-hmm. and I understand what you're saying and agree with it. Football's a controlled, violent sport that we embrace, endorse, and allow to happen. And if you're a home team, that is your house. Players often call it that. They defend it to the point where they want teams to be sorry they came in, and they want teams to be fearful of coming in. On that level, I totally get it. I think they could have solved the problem easily by just saying dome is where the heart is. It's also where we hurt people. And then I think no one can complain about that. But I understand how someone would dislike the slogan, home is where the heart is. It's also where we hurt people. And how it not necessarily sends the wrong message, but can endorse even, you know, in a complicated maze, the message that, home, that's fine to be hurting people when you're at home. I get it.
I'd agree with that if it was just script, but it's a picture of a football player. It's Ricky Foley, as you said.
Yeah.
So that's a stretch that I'm not buying it. I just don't see it. I think we got to be real careful with stuff like this too, because I think, you know, if we get overly sensitive about every little thing, we become sensitive to none of it. In my opinion, I think. You know, while it's great to have this discussion about it, the fact that we're talking about a football ad, basically, and domestic violence is beyond me. The two, there's just no correlation there at all.
In my eye. There's more irony at play here, too, in that, you know, you may or may not be aware, this probably are, but the Argos have been a community leader in anti-violence campaigning. Particularly
so.
Bullying.
Yeah.
They have done wonderful work in that area for many, many years, quietly for the most part, without a lot of accolades. So it is kind of ironic that they put up this poster with this slogan, which by no means would they have meant what some people take out of this slogan. And this is what they're getting publicity about.
You know, here's the thing. There's two basic points. One is, as I said, I don't see the correlation here. Two, though, I do see where Mike Layton, by saying this, gets his name in the paper, and that's all he's looking at, too. I don't doubt that he actually believes it, but I also think that's a stretch that not many people had when they first saw it. You said there were some that agreed with him, and there, you know, I'm sure there are. But for the most part, by looking at a poster of a football player and talking about the whole ad, by the way, is about you coming to watch them. The way that somehow becomes about domestic violence is beyond me. I don't get it at all.
So a clarification would be enough. Do you think that a clarification would be enough? Stating what we have stated here in this conversation,
well, just
quickly,
look,
this is not what it means, so the posters are staying. Yeah. Do you think that would have been fine?
I think, well, yeah, I do. Because I don't think for a minute, as you said, they're very, very conscious of violence and the community at large and domestic violence especially. There's no way that they meant it in this fashion.
Right.
And you know, to suggest for a moment that they did is, you know, I'd go so far as to say ludicrous. It's
almost insulting to them.
Absolutely.
Which brings us to, you know, a more general conversation where when we both had it as broadcasters, many people have had it in public life, that they'll say something they didn't mean what somebody else took from it. And they inferred, the listener inferred something and decided that's what you meant. Yeah. I demand an apology. And often we get apologies when I do personally believe that only a clarification is necessary. If you understood me to mean this, that isn't what I meant.
Yeah.
And I think that that should be enough. But it never is these days. No, you need to apologize because I mistook what you said. Makes no sense to me.
I couldn't agree with you more. And again, it comes back to people complain. That's what we do. Nobody, I venture to say you've got no one on city council who would stand up and say, with the possible exception of Rob Ford, although the Argos aren't NFL, boy, that's a, you know, it's a great campaign they got going. And I have to believe that there are just as many people around the city who believe that.
You know what, but I can give you a couple of examples. Karen Stintz, who was on the three councillor panel that reviews ads for the TCC, said that she doubted that the Argos needed to change this. And Norm Kelly, who's the TTC commissioner, said Layton's letter was an unnecessary attempt to shame the Argos. So there are people even, you know, in council who will agree that this is much ado about nothing. Just to conclude, I guess, I think they made a mistake. I mean, I think if I looked at this ad, I would have said, you know what? I think some people might find that. Can't we just change it to Dome is where the heart is? It's also where we hurt people. Or just change, because I get it as a football guy, but I think it might cause some trouble. I'd like to think that I would have at least voiced that concern before they went to print these things. But beyond that, clarifying that this in no way, shape, or form has us endorsing violence at home, it's a ridiculous notion.
You shouldn't even have to say it.
You
want to change one word. I want to throw one word at Mike Layton.
Bumble!
This is The Gist of It with Hayes and Landry.
The NHL pretty much done now for the summer. A very busy weekend. You had the July 1st, what they called it, the free agent frenzy. And it certainly was from the point of view of money spent. And there's always controversy, too. Let's get right to that. With Steve Simmons from the Toronto Sun suggesting that Brian Burke, who spent the day with our troops in Afghanistan, should have been here. He should have been at least visible because what he did, I think, was give up on the Brad Richards situation. He wasn't there to sell personally. And that somehow, optically, it didn't look good. That he was far away, maybe making the Brian Burke brand a little stronger by, you know, playing to the troops, as it were. What do you make of all that?
I don't know Brian Burke well enough to comment on what motivated him. So I guess what I need to do is offer what might motivate me in this situation and how I feel about him being away. At first blush, I will admit, I felt that there might be a derelict of duty here. When it comes to the Maple Leafs and free agency. But as I thought about it, I started to figure there was another duty that he felt strongly about, which superseded this. And that is, when you get a call from the Department of Defense, let me put you in his shoes. You get a call from the Department of Defense, and they say to you, we would be very honored if you were part of a group that we're taking to Afghanistan for Canada Day to help bring the morale of the troops up. A group of people who, by the way, will be coming home hopefully safely very soon, and this might be the last chance you get for a trip like this. Would I personally feel that that was too big an honor to overlook? I would. I think I'm like a lot of people in this country who feel very respectful and thankful to troops. And if I were honored to be asked to go and be part of a program that was going to help them in some way, shape, or form, even a small way, I'd have to go. I would want to make sure that my duties here back at home were looked after. And I think Brian Burke did that.
I think that's true. I must confess, like you, my first reaction was, yeah, he's got a point. What's Burke doing in Afghanistan? Upon further reflection, did change my view. Mainly because I think that the whole reason he should have been here was that dog and pony show in Mississauga, where they were trying to somehow coerce Brad Richards into signing with them.
Right.
All along, we've heard that, well, if anybody can, you know, sell it, Brian Burke can sell it. And I think that, you know, he didn't necessarily do that by being in Afghanistan. But you're right. He had a greater duty. I understand that. And I but what got me, and I think this is a bigger part of this, the story then became about how dare you bring up this issue.
Right.
And a lot of people were really dumping on Steve Simmons. I happen to think that he had a point. I may not agree with it, but he had a point.
I don't disagree with that. And I like you, at first blush, did feel, yeah, what's he doing?
Mm-hmm.
And I, like you, thought about it, which, again, in this day and age seems to be a negative for some people. Some people think, well, you're not very decisive if you kind of thought this way first, and then
make
you
make your decision right away.
I think I was thoughtful about it. I wanted to get more information, and I was satisfied with the answers I got from Brian Burke. I understood why he would be upset about it. And as I mentioned before, I understand the lure of taking part in something like that would be awfully strong. And when he then explains that he has many great, knowledgeable, and capable lieutenants here who charged by him to take care of these situations, and that he dotted I's and crossed T's before. I take him at face value, and I think a guy who is as capable a general manager and as thoughtful a general manager would do that, would have this in place before he left.
Don't you think, though, that one of the reasons this became a bigger issue was that on the day itself, July 1st, when so many free agents were signed, the Leafs didn't sign anybody.
Right.
And so, again, if you take what Simmons was saying, optically it didn't look good. I think he had a point there.
Sure.
You know, but when you look at it a little deeper, you can understand it. And keep in mind, too, Luke Shen was there. And if you go down to Leaf games, you know one of the things that happens every third period is they spotlight a Canadian soldier, one of Luke's troops. He gives a pair of tickets away every game to someone in the military. And so it's a big deal to him as well.
Right.
You know, my understanding, too, is I've heard that Brad Richards is a big follower of the troops and a big backer of the troops as well. And in his particular case, I don't think Burke's not being there had any impact. But
and I think he knew that.
Oh, I think all along he knew.
And that's a salient point, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he really felt or knew that it's a 50-50 thing with Brad Richards, and my presence might make a difference if he may have made a different decision. I don't believe that there was any waffling on his part or any question in his mind what Brad Richards was going to do, at least as far as the Leafs were concerned.
Everybody has been talking all year about Brad Richards ending up in New York.
Correct.
I mean, that's people who are somewhat knowledgeable, maybe not even a little bit knowledgeable, but it's been a given, and sure enough, that's exactly what happened. I think Brian Burke would have known that.
It is possible in this day and age to not know about something that seemingly the rest of the world knows about.
Really? How?
Well, a perfect example is you sent me an email with possible topics for this podcast, and you wrote Casey Anthony. And I went, I know the name, but I'm not sure why. It's not a trial that I followed closely at all. And seemingly everyone in the United States did, and maybe most of Canada too.
A lot of people here did too.
And of course, when I then clicked, you know, Googled the name, got the stories, and I went, I realize. But it is possible to not be swept up in the largest stories
so
out there.
So you live under a rock?
I guess so. But there, again, it's a large story that has me feeling a lot of different things and a lot of different viewpoints coming in from different angles. And I think what struck me most yesterday in watching the coverage was, I feel sorry for the jury. And I understood when a spokesperson came out and said, nobody on the jury wants to meet the media. Mm-hmm. I got that. Did you not? I completely understood why no one on that jury would want to be known. They will be known eventually, I do believe. And they face a tough road, considering the outrage that is being seen everywhere, particularly, again, on the Twitter sphere over this case.
Well, there was an awful lot of people who were watching this case. It was very high profile. And let's not forget, little two-year-old Kaylee Anthony died. And no one's sure how. And that's really the gist of the whole thing. No one is sure how.
Right.
And the jury, I think, did the right thing. Because, you know, this is a capital case. That means she could be executed. Kaylee Anthony could, in fact, face lethal injection. Well, that's an awfully tough thing to put on a jury when you're not willing or able to tell them how Kaylee Anthony died. And that's the gist of all of this. And, you know, it's really simple. You know, this is a woman who I think is detestable in almost every phase of her life. She comes from a dysfunctional family. She
allegedly lied. I mean, do you think that was proven?
Well, I think no matter what happened, the family's dysfunctional on some level. There's no question about that. I don't know that I don't believe that she was actually abused sexually by her father, but you know, to me, that doesn't necessarily mean that there weren't some deep issues in that family. This kid had some deep and troubling issues she was dealing with. Not the least of which was that she was a single mother who had a two-year-old, and she wanted to still be single. She saw everyone else her age out there doing, you know, the party circuit, and that's what she wanted. And because of that, people who don't know the details of how anything happened find her reprehensible. I do too. You can't defend her.
Your child, your two-year-old, is at the very least missing, and you don't report it for 31 days. That's hardly believable. It's not believable. No. And in the meantime, you're getting a tattoo and you're entering hot body contests at bars. It does not compute on any level with any reasonable thinking person.
No, but the problem with it is that, and this is where the disconnect comes, you have to prove that. And what I had seen of the trial, I didn't watch all of it, but I certainly read about it most of the time. I never saw proof of it. I want to know not just, you know, this theory of how she died. You got to tell me how she died. You got to tell me how she did it, you know, and that didn't happen. And so I think the jury, and like you say, in a very difficult position, did the right thing.
Decided that legally
they had to.
It was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And the jury is being mocked in some corners for not taking notes. I actually heard somebody complaining that when they were watching the trial, that some members of the jury were sitting there with their arms folded, as though, you know, that means they're not listening intently.
Oh, it's nonsense.
It's a very difficult position to be placed in. One of the backbones of the system is jury of your peers, correct? But it also means you're not expert in anything. And so when you were faced with the kind of pretzeling a defense attorney will do in a circumstantial case like this, trying to make head or tail fact from fiction, is an immense task for anyone. Never mind just somebody who might be a broadcaster, who might be a gardener, might work at Walmart.
It's really easy to make an opinion of something that you were watching peripherally. You come to some decision as to what you think happened, and that's the way it is.
Yeah.
Well, in actual fact, as a juror, it's a whole lot more difficult. You have to be proven. Something has to be proven. And in this case, it didn't happen.
It's Phil Hayes and Don Landry, and you're getting the gist of it.
Okay, so we've determined that you have some empathy, sympathy perhaps, for the jury in the Kaylee Anthony trial.
I think they made the right decision. Let's be clear.
That's fine. I get that. But I also get the impression that you don't feel at all the same way about her attorneys.
I'm pained about the job defense attorneys can do at times, especially during high-profile cases. And Jose Baez is one of those attorneys. And I don't know the man, but I have concern over the system and the way it, I don't think it forces defense attorneys to try and turn the penal code into a pretzel, but they do it. And it strikes me that defense attorneys aren't about justice. They're about winning, and winning at all costs. And I think we saw that at the OJ trial, to bring up another a high-profile case. There are others that have happened closer to home that I can point to that I think that the defense attorney was just trying to get another notch in the win column. And I don't think that's necessarily about justice. It's about thumping your chest and saying, I did the impossible.
But hold it, though.
Look at me.
Just a second. Jeff Ashton, the prosecutor in the case, who's decided to retire after it, by the way, he also was out to get the win. The way I see it is, sometimes...
I think for different reasons, so,
well,
Bill.
No, not at all. I think that... I guess by definition, it is about the win, but really what it's about is the system. If you believe in the system, everybody deserves a defense. And you have to give the best defense possible. And part of having that mindset is to actually believe that you want to win, to believe that the person you're representing is, I don't want to say they all believe they're innocent or whatnot. I don't believe that. But it is about giving that proper defense that we all deserve. My father was an attorney, and he was the type of guy who would, on occasion, defend people who were accused of some rather heinous crimes. I won't go into details, but I remember having a discussion with him once about it, and I said, like, how can you defend somebody like that? Somebody who's accused of something so bad. And his answer was, someone has to do it. It's part of the system we live in. And whether you like it or not, if you buy into the system, you have to buy into the premise that perhaps this guy isn't guilty, but that you have to give him that best defense. And once in a while, that means someone who's guilty will get off. But generally speaking, the system works.
I understand that theory, and I'm not so sure that the system is working. I think it continues to break down because of publicity, because of histrionics. I think there just needs to be more responsibility towards justice as a whole for defense attorneys as opposed to defending their client to the utmost of their ability. And I think there has to be some reason involved as well. And I think oftentimes defense attorneys go beyond... Look, it's reasonable doubt, the burden of proof for
burden
the prosecution.
That's right.
You should have to be reasonable when you are providing alternate theories of crimes in courtrooms. And I think that definition is becoming murkier and murkier as we go.
Well, I guess I've stepped on some toes here. I just think that's the system. And you know what? The system works. And in this particular case, I may not like it. I may think she did something, but the system worked.
The system can be changed, it can be augmented, it can be improved, and it needs to be, least in the United States. You need to make defense attorneys more responsible for what they offer as, quote, reasonable alternative theories of crimes. You shouldn't be able to just waltz into a... They have way too much latitude as opposed to prosecutors.
Nonsense.
They do. They have way more latitude than prosecutors do. I mean, we just saw it again. We saw it at the OJ trial.
But
to argue that they don't have more latitude is ludicrous.
Wait, no.
You can just come in and you can just offer any kind of cockamamie,
the way
plausible
the
or implausible
works,
theory.
It doesn't matter what they say. They can throw everything at the wall. It doesn't matter. All they have to do is get you thinking there's some kind of reasonable doubt. And the burden of proof in these cases is on the prosecution. When you go to trial, they have to prove you did it. You don't have to prove you didn't.
I understand that, Bill. I'm not asking for the burden of proof to be lessened for prosecutors. I'm asking that defense attorneys be held to a higher standard when it comes to the defenses that they are offering to their clients. People who weren't even on trial were on trial in the Casey Anthony case.
Like her father.
Yes. And, and a defense attorney can just come in and just start offering. Look, he had a problem. His client lied. Often. Now, I don't think for a second that he sat across from her and said, boy, she's just a great girl who didn't do this, and I wonder why she lied. Tell me why you lied. I think it was, I've got a legal problem, and I have to dance around this. I have to come up with some kind of an explanation as to why it's believable that she couldn't.
But he didn't, because she was convicted of four counts of lying. So
that doesn't change his motivation in my mind. Just because she was, but he did a bad job of that. Or no, he did a good job of that. Yes, she did lie. And here's why.
But I don't think that had any bearing on whether she was convicted of killing Kaylee or not. The whole situation came down to the prosecution didn't do the job. And I you know what? In their particular case, I don't think that they had any chance. The problem here is you have a two-year-old girl, and that means society wants a killer to answer for it. And in this case, everything pointed to Casey being the guilty party. But the facts are, you can't take her to court and charge her and try her for capital murder until you know what happened. And they didn't. That, to me, is the biggest mistake made here, and that's the prosecution that made that.
And I am wondering if the jury convicts, if the defense isn't allowed to go off on some flight of fancy.
This is The Gist of It with Landry and Hayes.
This week, Statistics Canada released a poll. They polled people who didn't vote in the federal election on May 2nd.
Shame, shame.
What were some of your reasons for not voting? I found some of this interesting. Off the top, almost 4%, 3.8%, let's call it 4, Bill, said they forgot to vote. How do you forget to vote?
Those are the kind of people who didn't even know Casey Anthony was on trial.
oh, come on. I think it's BS, isn't
it?
Throwing
it out there.
Look, I can't really be bothered to. Maybe I should probably lump them with another group that I find very intriguing, too. Not interested and too busy. If you add them together, it's about 51%. Let's put the other, it's about 55%. For these people, basically, it was a federal meh election.
Sure.
I'm not so sure that I care that much if people who are uninterested don't vote. I want people who are interested in the political process to be voting. If you are not interested enough to actually get out there and cast a ballot, that's cool. The rest of us who really think about this often have opinions, get really into it.
Yeah, I'd
maybe
agree
we should be in control of who's forming the government anyway.
Here's the thing. If you force people to vote, you would get a lot of people who were uninformed and go, well, you know, yeah. I like him because he looks good in a tie.
Another part of this poll, since you bring that up, I think this is kind of funny. Quebec non-voters. Non-voters in Quebec, Bill, were most likely to say their vote wouldn't make a difference. Nearly 35% of those polled, giving that reason, they thought their vote wouldn't make a difference. I can tell you in Quebec, particularly your vote made a hell of a
huge
difference.
Oh yeah, you know, because I gotta believe this election in Quebec may have been the weirdest thing in Canadian history. How the NDP got people elected who had never been to their ridings. Astonishing.
You know what, that candidate spending the campaign, or at least part of it, in Las Vegas, that's kind of like what I'd want to do. Good enough reason to vote. I mean, I hope I didn't sound elitist earlier when I said, if you're not interested, just leave it to the people who are interested.
Well, you know what? You'll get people who will say that, but they're wrong. Because if you do have people who aren't interested, who don't take the time to even look into the issues and just vote on, you know, non-substantial reasons, you skew elections and you end up with situations much like what happened in Quebec.
A lot of these reasons that were given were just, they don't stand up either. Like, I was out of town, that's about 10%. Well, there were advance polls, and I think we were all fairly well aware of those. In fact, my wife and I voted at an advance poll. But maybe I'm looking at it through the wrong end of the telescope. I often do that, Bill. What do we do to entice people to come to the polls? You know, drinks and appies? What do they want from their polling station? It's not exciting enough there. Did Rick Mercer have to be there in person thanking them for voting?
That would be a nice touch.
I wouldn't mind that, actually.
That might work.
Bill, are you familiar with a gentleman by the name of Meta World Peace?
Sadly, I call him Ron.
As in Artest.
Exactly.
Ron Artest has decided that he'd like to change his name officially, legally, to Meta World Peace. Shades of World Be Free, which was
Lloyd Free.
Yeah. I mean, at least, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Well, he had the free part already, didn't he?
Here's the thing. World, I'm all for world peace.
World peace.
Yeah, meta world, not just mega world peace. You want the whole shinola or whatever you want to call it. The fact is,
it's not hyphenated either, by the way. I want you to know that his middle name is World.
Of course it would be. It's ludicrous. And this is the guy who went up into the stands, what, in 2004?
That sounds about right.
It's ridiculous.
Somebody threw a drink at him. Don't throw drinks at people. There should be some payback for that kind of thing.
Sure, okay.
But he has decided, he's been trying to turn over a new leaf. I mean, whether you believe it or not, the name thing is just, it's window dressing, of course. But, I mean, he did win a championship with the LA Lakers. And you know what he did? He auctioned off his championship ring. And the proceeds went to a mental health research and care facility. So, I mean, the guy's at least trying.
Oh, he's extremely trying. I think, firstly, it's wonderful to be all for world peace. But let's try reality. Hey, world, try Earth. It's a nice place to visit.
I am just saying. I think it's an indicator that, you know, when he says his name is now going to be and wants it to be Meta World Peace, it's better than choosing Gangster Thug Knuckles. He could have been, and look at it. That's not a bad name for you. Gangster Thug Knuckles. Yeah. Bill Hayes will now become Gangster Thug Knuckles. Have you ever come up with a pseudonym for yourself? Because I have done this before. And I also have a theory. Do you agree with this? That if you listen carefully every day, you can pull out a couple of words or a phrase that will make either a great band name or an album name or a pseudonym, like Gangster Thug Knuckles, which is perfect for you. I have come up with years ago, Breezy Trees. Sure. If I ever become a jazz artist, that's what I'll do. Foggy Pockets. Again, came out of conversations in a sentence and you lift it. That's a great pseudonym. Chunky Crumbles is another one that I came up with. For some reason, the words chunky and crumbles came together in a sentence from somebody, and I lifted them out and went, this is a great pseudonym.
It makes me hungry.
Yeah. Nothing like that
for
you.
You know what? No, seriously, I'd be okay for that.
We've already done it. We've got Gangster Thug Knuckles. But if we have a conversation about almost anything here, experiment, all right? You bring up a topic, start talking. I think I can probably lift something out of the conversation. That'll be a good name for you. Do it.
Okay, well, I don't know. I mean, I can think of knick-knack, paddywhack, give a dog a bone.
That's not really a conversation, Bill.
No?
No.
But it does include a name that I did once think about using on air,
yeah,
which was paddywax. WAX. Yeah. I thought, you know what? That's kind of a cool name. However, thankfully, reason prevailed, and I didn't go. Can you imagine going through life and having people actually refer to you as Mr. Wax?
It's Bill Hayes and Don Landry, and you're getting the gist of it.
Hey, Don, do you get downtown a lot?
As often as I can. That Petula Clark song really had an effect on me.
Yeah, I get down. Yeah. Well, I like Don't Sleep in
Come on,
Subway,
sing. You know people want it. Thing. People have asked for you to sing more often.
They have. Generally when they're on a long distance phone on the other end.
But, half in the bag.
Oh yeah, you really don't want to hear me sing. But the reason I ask is that, you know, I used to work at Young and Dundas, and I was in the area quite a bit. And
what kind of a food cart was it?
Thank you. We went through a lot of mustard, and you can probably imagine why. But the thing is that there's a plan afoot to change Young Street between Young and Girard. Generally considered one of the seedier parts of Young. I would argue that, you know, north of Wellesley maybe a little bit more, or up around Wellesley might be seedier. But the point is, they send it down to two lanes instead of four. Two lanes north, two lanes south, one way each way. And broaden the sidewalks. Now,
it's a great idea.
I don't see any reason why not to do it all the way the length of Young Street. Why just there? I mean, it's not like Young Street is a street that you need to navigate if you're on a car.
Right.
You can avoid it at all costs.
Tube goes right under there.
Absolutely. I've been in cities where they do that. And
Times Square is a perfect example. Part of Broadway closed down. It's wonderful there.
Oh, yeah. It's Copenhagen. One of my favorite cities in the world, by the way. And most of downtown.
Why is that, Bill?
It's a very beautiful country.
Did you go there often, and why? Were you just getting Carl Holman Carlsberg turtlenecks, or was there another reason?
I was only there once, but I go frequently in my mind.
I don't remember much about the trip.
But the thing is, they have boulevards throughout their downtown area, and I've been in other places where that's the case. Burlington, Vermont does it. And, it brings people out, especially in an area like Yonge and Dundas, which we've tried many times to fix up, to bring people in. It makes an awful lot of sense to me.
It does.
And I would say, like I said, all the way up, I would say maybe from Front Street. Front Street up to, say, Bloor. One lane each way, broaden the sidewalks, Bob's your uncle.
Small-minded of you. Not nearly grandiose enough for my liking.
Okay.
All the way to Thunder Bay, Bill.
Thunder Bay, sure.
Yonge Street goes all the way to Thunder Bay. Why don't we turn it into a giant pedestrian mall? All the way to Thunder Bay. The world's largest pedestrian mall. Last week we were talking about tourism and how to draw people.
Yeah, that'd do
it. Don't think you could draw people in from all over the world who like to walk the length of Yonge Street?
Yeah, you got a month?
To Thunder Bay.
Be like renaming everybody Terry Fox. Now, if you were to sleep in the subway, to go back to Petula Clark, what station would you want to sleep in?
Bathurst Station, I suppose, is the place. Well, no, not a lot of sleeping going on there. According to Craigslist, they have this thing, what is it called, misconnections? And people will often, I saw you here.
Yeah.
You're the blonde girl in the ponytail. I had, you know. And according to statistics that they were able to glean from these kinds of ads, Bathurst Station is the third most romantic in the country. There are two in Montreal that rank ahead. Well, Montreal, I think, is just a little more romantic. Yes. But Bathurst Station is the most romantic in Toronto. And I can only think, if I were to come up with a reason for that, I think there's just a certain kind of sexual energy and tension that comes from Honest Ed's. Have you ever picked up at a subway station, a streetcar, when you were a younger man? I know you've been happily married for a long time. I'm not trying to
I vaguely remember it.
I have never picked up on the subway. I've never picked up anywhere. I could never understand the pickup. Like, people say, go to a grocery store. It's the best place to pick women up. And I never really figured out what's, I guess, the catalyst from, excuse me, does this asparagus look good to you, to hot and sweaty between the sheets, you know, a week later or whatever.
Well, there's
the
thing.
Or even getting to a date.
You're using asparagus? Go with the cucumber.
As we get out of here for another week, Bill, promise me this. Promise me that next week you'll give us a status on your golf game. Folks, he's worried. He's going to Scotland to play at fabled St. Andrews and has heard that people get kicked off if they're not good enough.
Oh, it is a major concern, but I'm working on it. I am working on it.
What are your odds of getting through 18 holes right now, do you think?
Pretty good. Excellent, I'd say no, but all right. Pretty good.
I want a status update next week. As we close the show, let me just say this. Bob Rae this week announced that the Liberal Summer Caucus Retreat will be held in Ottawa. A couple of picnic tables at Mooney's Bay ought to do it, Bill. And maybe a bucket of KFC.
And that's The Gist of It for another week. The Gist of It is available every Wednesday afternoon through iTunes or at donlandry.com.